Veterans Radio has a partnership with Literature of War Foundation to exchange podcast content to reach a wider audience regarding issues of interest to veterans, family, and friends. You can find more about Literature of War Foundation at its website, litofwar.com. You can find more about Veterans Radio on Facebook or its website, veteransradio.org. I am Jim Foss-Hone, a host of Veterans Radio and a veterans disability lawyer at LegalHelpForVeterans.com, a sponsor of this podcast. In today's episode, Literature of War Foundation is talking to New York Times bestselling author Sebastian Younger. He's talking about the healing power of having a stage with an audience that is willing to listen, and his new book, In My Time of Dying. He's a New York Times bestselling author. He wrote Tribe War, Freedom, A Death in Belmont, Fire, and also wrote The Perfect Storm. He's been a co-director of the documentary film Rest Repo, which was nominated for an Academy Award. He's also a winner of a Peabody Award and the National Magazine Award for Reporting. So enjoy this podcast from Literature of War.
Welcome to the Lit War Podcast by Lethal Minds Journal, where we seek out the moments that made us who we are today, one story at a time. I'm your host, Michael Jerome Plunkett, and my guest today is best-selling author and award-winning journalist Sebastian Younger. Sebastian has spent a career covering everything from the most dangerous jobs in America to major international news stories around the world. His work examines the complexities of military service and why so many people miss the war once they come home. He is also the founder of Vets Town Hall, which seeks to give veterans of any era a chance to stand before their community and speak about what it was like to serve their country. He is the best-selling author of The Perfect Storm, War, Tribe, Freedom, and coming in May of 2024, In My Time of Dying. He joins us today with a story.
Sebastian Younger, welcome to the Lit War Podcast. Do you have a story for us?
Do you want a story about myself or just a story from the world somewhere?
Most important moment of your life, putting you on the spot.
I'm going to have to go with two. It went at both ends of my life. I'm 61. And the things that are important and that change you and affect you, they change as you go through your ages, you know. And I think one of the most important moments of my life was when my father was an upper middle class European from a sort of intellectual background. His dad was Jewish, and they fled Europe when the fascists started taking over everything. They came into Spain in 36 and then to France in 40, and he came to this country because, as he said, the fascists would never come here. And he was a smart guy, made a good living, and he was pretty affluent. And we lived well, right? And at one point, we had a friend who was a stockbroker who made enormous amounts of money, right? And this was like maybe 1970. And you know, I was a child, and I was very impressed by money. And I said something to my dad, like, "Oh my God, what's Jack do? Whatever his name was." And he goes, "Oh, Jack just spends his life making money." And I was like, wait, I thought that was the point, right? He's like, no, no, no. Money, he's like, money is the least interesting thing in the world. Like, if you're making money and not doing something else that's real with your life, you're not really living, it's a wasted life. And I never forgot that. Like, I mean, my father was affluent, you know, he wanted to be comfortable, but he never made the mistake that money was the point. And, I took that with me through my whole life, and I'm very lucky to live comfortably as well. I made a good living as a writer, and I'm glad I'm not working for $8 an hour somewhere, of course, right? But you had, at the end of the day, what are we alive for, right? We're alive to love other people, to be loved, to help other people, to help human dignity, to understand existence, you know, and money has nothing to do with those things. And at the very end of my life, Until now, I almost died. I had a ruptured aneurysm that almost killed me. And I saw my father hovering above me as I was dying, and they managed to save me. But there he was. And I'm an atheist. I'm a rationalist. I'm not only am I not a mystic, I can say I'm an anti-mystic. Like I just hate all that stuff. Right. And there he was. And it made me realize this other important thing, like, careful, you don't know everything. Like, you may know nothing. Like, keep your mind open to all things.
Right. Wow. That's so, now to take that a step further, that experience, that near death experience that you described and seeing your father, did that rattle your rational beliefs? I mean, you say that, like, you know, it's kind of a moment of recognition of, like, you don't know everything, but did that change the way you looked at it? Or do you still consider yourself an atheist?
Well, it's interesting. People blend the idea of there being a God with there being something that happens after death. They're completely different things. And there could be a post-death reality and no God, right? Or there could be a God that oversees a completely physical world in which we're just biological beings and we utterly and completely ceased existing in every form when we die, even though there's a God, right? So there really are different things. So what I would say is, I am an atheist. I do not believe in God. It does not order my life. It does not change. It does not affect what I do. And I don't think that's a plausible explanation for how the universe works and got started, right? But now I knew that when we die, that's it forever. We are biological beings. And when we rot and decompose, we are no longer, right? And I, as a journalist, I've seen people who were dead an hour. I've seen people who were dead a week. I've seen people who were dead a month or 3 months. And at all those stages, it's hard not to think, wow, there's nothing else. Like, that's it, right? And particularly at 3 months, you're like, wow, I'm not even sure that's a body. You know, so the idea that we continue existing just seems implausible. But now I have to say, because of what I experienced with my father, I don't know. And it's possible that in physical terms or in subatomic terms, that there is some reality post-death that we just do not understand, that has something to do with how the universe was formed at an atomic level, right? Like, this is talking about the physical nature of the universe, like the way, gravity has nothing to do with God, right? Gravity is an elemental force, right? Well, likewise, consciousness may have nothing to do with God. It might be a fundamental force in the universe like gravity is.
Well, I mean, I think that's a really balanced perspective. You know, so often a discussion like that can go like one of two ways. Is like, you can get everybody's already in agreement with each other, or everybody's at each other's throats within, you know, a couple of minutes of putting those opinions out there. But I think, like you said, your experience as a journalist, you end up and you've lived at the extreme ends of the world in a variety of different situations with all your different books and all your different experiences. But it's true, when you experience death in that way up close and personal, and, you know, from my personal experiences working on an emergency ambulance, you know, transporting to emergency scenes, it's like you really begin to, I mean, just doing 2 months of that, I was like, I had to reconsider a lot of my own opinions about death and about life too, right? Like, the idea of when does life start? When you have, there's so many complications that our bodies are so strange. And I think, I feel like it's one of those things where if you're not seeing that in some form or another, you can get very comfortable in a certain worldview, but being exposed to that over and over again can really rattle that cage. I mean, do you feel like your experiences as a writer have cemented some of that or kind of brought that to the surface? Or when did that experience kind of, when did you form those kind of beliefs?
Well, I grew up in a godless household, right? I mean, I was raised by an artist and a physicist, and we never went to church. And my father, who was an enormously compassionate, beautiful man, morally speaking, had absolutely no use for religion or for God. And in fact, thought that that religion was the source of an awful lot of conflict and death and destruction in the world. And we're seeing a little bit of it right now overseas, obviously, and Israel. And so, I just never thought about it. I'm just like, okay, this is what we get. We're social primates, right? We have the exact same sort of, quote, afterlife that chimpanzees do, or lions might, or ants do. Like, what we're made out of biology, right? And so when we go, we go. And thank God. I mean, imagine an eternity of consciousness. I could barely get through math class in eighth grade. Are you kidding? You want me to stay awake for eternity? No exit? No way out? I can't even get kicked out of class? Like, Jesus. Forgive the use of the Lord's name, but Jesus Christ, like, I don't want that. Who wants that, right? So, I was I just grew up not thinking about it and concentrating on my life as I was living it. And so now I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, in 1900, the physicists didn't understand the subatomic world and the quantum world, right? And they eventually found out it made no sense in macroscopic terms, right? All of this, the sort of law, Newton's laws, right? Sort of Newtonian era laws of physics didn't apply at the subatomic level. And, you know, likewise, you know, maybe there's something going on after we die at that subatomic level that we just do not understand. And there's an awful lot of weirdness. I mean, there's something called the double slit experiment. And I shouldn't talk about this too much because my book's coming out in 6 months and I can't ruin the party for my publisher, but I'll sort of end with this just as sort of an enigmatic thing to think about. Like, in case we think we know everything, it's been demonstrated many, many times that if you send a photon at two slits and you don't watch it, you don't observe it, it will go through both slits at the same time. Basically, you walking through two doorways simultaneously, impossible in the macroscopic world, right? And it will, and you can see that from the strike plate on the other side, the signature on the strike plate on the other side. If you watch it, if you observe it, if there's conscious observation, the photon has to pick one slit and goes through one, right? Otherwise, it does something that should not be possible in terms of Newtonian physics. So there's a great mystery, right? And so if that great mystery applies to what happens after we die, it wouldn't shock me.
Wow. Yeah, I've heard of that experiment before. It's very, very famous experiment about the observable world. And like you said, the mystery that really is beyond that, what we can see and what we can't see and what we can understand and what is yet to be understood. And so just when is your new book? What's it called? And when is it coming out?
It's called In My Time of Dying. Okay. From the old gospel song. How's that for an old atheist? Gospel song and Led Zeppelin song. Okay. Like, has to be clear here, In My Time of Dying, and it will come out May 21st with Simon & Schuster.
Awesome. Very much looking forward to, we've spoken about that a couple of times now, and I'm very much looking forward to reading that, and we'll make sure we get the word out about that. But maybe to switch gears here a little bit, today I want to talk about a specific moment in another one of your books, Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, a book that I've read several times, and I think there is a tremendous amount to be taken away from and kind of sit with. And, you know, this is a book that's about the power of sitting in communion with one another. Kind of, as you said before, there's a lot of conflict going on in the world right now as we're talking here, multiple different countries involved. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. Here in the United States, we've had unparalleled, animosity amongst our citizens, fellow countrymen, like in a way that really hasn't been seen probably since arguably the 60s, if not even earlier than that. There's a moment in Tribe very close to the end where you describe an experience with the author Carl Marlantis, who is a Vietnam War veteran, also an author. And you talk about an experience that you had when the two of you were having some type of speaking event. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what happened?
Yeah, if I'm remembering correctly, I should have reread that section and I forgot to in the chaos of my life. But there was Carl and I were talking, and I think the topic had sort of turned to this puzzling thing, like why do soldiers, war is hell, as the cliche goes, and indeed it is, but it's a lot of things, and not just hell, and we were sort of, the talk sort of turned to, like, why do soldiers sometimes miss war? In fact, many soldiers often miss war, and often they come home to this society that I'm sure they miss. They miss their families and their girlfriends and, you know, going to Burger King or whatever. And then now they're back. Here they are. You got it, man. You made it home. You're alive. Congratulations. Like, here you are. And they don't feel like they have a place. They don't feel like they want to be here. What is that? And, you know, there's some real reasons, right? I mean, there's some interesting reasons that reflect what we need as human beings, and mostly we need closeness, and you get an awful lot of closeness in war, and then when you come back there's less of it. And on some level, you know, I think that the human psyche is like, you know what, the trials and assaults to human dignity that war is actually worth it to get the closeness that we all need, and this safe society, like, that is absent all of those horrors, it's also absent any real human closeness, any real community. And you know what? I'm not interested. And that's it says a lot about what we are as social primates, right? What kind of animals we are. Well, this gentleman got up and he was very, very upset. I mean, really in a rage that we would suggest that soldiers missed war. And he stormed out of the room or something very much like that. Again, I'm sort of going from memory here for something that happened many years ago, Carl, you know, Carl was, you know, he was very I mean, I was sort of annoyed, right? I mean, it's like, come on, man, this is you know, there's no room for rage here. Like, I mean, this is a collection of peaceful people and we're just having a conversation. Don't bring that in here. I didn't say that. This is what I thought. Right. And Carl was basically like, yeah, that's war too. Like, you know, when you go to war, you're going to get some people that are really angry. Like, sorry, that's part of the package, right? Along with everyone who is saluting and proudly talking about their service, you're going to get that guy too. You know what? So you're either in for the whole package or you're not. But don't be selective about what, you know, what parts of this you find to your taste.
Right. Now, and the assumption here, I don't know if you caught up with that gentleman or if he was waiting in the lobby for you when you were leaving, but the assumption there was that he was a veteran as well, that he was.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, Carl said, yeah, of course, Carl said that. He's like, probably a Vietnam. You know, he was of the age where he could have been a Vietnam vet. He also was of the age where he could have been a Vietnam conscientious objector.
Right.
And equally outraged at the suggestion. Right. So it really could have gone either way. I didn't talk about that with Carl, but in retrospect now, I'm like, wow, it could have been either.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because you've got, so both you and Carl have experienced war. Carl was a Marine Corps lieutenant, rifleman, leading a rifle platoon in Vietnam. You were embedded with infantry units during a war. You experienced, you're not a veteran yourself, but you experienced war as close as a person can experience it, in some of the most intense fighting of the war in Afghanistan. Now, and if we assume that this individual was, you know, a veteran himself and experienced war in his own ways, I mean, I think there's something to unpack there, in the sense that we've got three individuals and the crowd as well, that, you know, who is listening to this, but three individuals who experienced the thing they're all talking about, and three or two rather very distinct reactions to it. Now, you kind of, in Tribe, you use this experience to kind of open up a broader concept of people speaking with each other, not just being in communion with one another, but communicating effectively. Was that the impetus for starting Vets Town Hall?
Yeah. So I studied anthropology in college, and it sort of struck me that, you know, there was all this talk, and rightfully so, this talk about trauma. And we were seeing people who were really incapacitated by wartime trauma. And I just sort of, as an anthropologist, I just sort of thought, like, that's odd. Like, human life surely has been extremely traumatic since the beginning. Mm-hmm. There are very dangerous predators out there. Warfare has been part of the human experience from the beginning. The natural world is a harsh place, and we evolved in it for hundreds of thousands of years. It can't be that trauma is incapacitating. Because if it were, the human race wouldn't exist. Like, give me a break. Like, a mastodon charges through camp and kills, you know, you, like, whatever. Like, and then everyone's paralyzed with, you know, like, grief and trauma for the rest of their lives. Who's feeding these people? Like, who's, like, come on. I do not believe it, right? And so, and it's not that I thought people were exaggerating their claim, although I think sometimes people do that. Sometimes people do everything, right? But I feel like, I think the people that were really were suffering when they came back from the wars that America was in, it occurred to me that maybe what part of their suffering wasn't just the trauma that they experienced. I've experienced trauma. It affected me enormously. It didn't incapacitate me. As a private citizen, I was a journalist overseas. I couldn't go to government to get a disability check. It went away, right? It's like when you lose a good friend, when they die, yeah, you're paralyzed with grief for a week and then very sad for a month. And then you think about them a lot for a year. And 20 years later, I'm sorry, you've moved on, right? You're not still sobbing on a couch, except for once in a while, right? And maybe on the anniversary, you know, but people are adapted to recover from things, from terrible things. And so, but what it may be is that in the military, you're traumatized in a group. You're in a unit, right? You're in a squad, you're in a platoon. And then you come home, and for most of human history, people have come home from combat and continued the healing process in and amongst the group that they were in combat with. Not in this society. You are in and amongst people who don't have any idea what you went through, right? One of the ways that the Native American societies in North America dealt with some of this was to allow warriors the chance to address the entire community when they got back from fighting, right? And it was called the Gourd Dance. And it was started with the Kiowa, a Southern Plains tribe, but sort of spread everywhere. And basically when the warriors came back from combat, they had the chance, each warrior had the chance to sing, to dance, to retell his exploits before the tribe, for the community, what he did for them, right? The people he killed for them, the people he lost for them, the wounds he suffered, the risks he took, the pride he feels in his service, the sorrow he feels, you know, et cetera, right? His anger at the leaders, you know, whatever, right? And not only does it allow for a very powerful cathartic experience for the warrior, but it allows/forces the whole community to engage, to take moral responsibility for the fighting. This isn't just mine. This is all of ours. I did this for you. I have blood on my hands. I lost my brother out there. Like, that means we all have blood on our hands. We all lost a brother. We're all in this. If you're going to send me out there to do this work, I'll gladly do it with honor, right? With pride. But it better be the moral responsibility and the emotional fallout had better be undertaken by everybody. The problem with the mass industrial society is that we don't know any of the people that are keeping us alive, right? I don't know any oil workers that drill an oil out of the ground that keep my apartment warm and my car running, right? I don't know any farmers that grew the wheat that I'm eating. Like, none of us know any of these people, right? And a lot of people don't know the soldiers that are keeping us safe, right? And so that is not, that has not been true for most of human history. This is a new situation. So what Vets Town Hall tries to do is on Veterans Day, the town halls are not open for business. There's a parade and whatnot, which is great, but whatever. I don't think it has a lot of therapeutic value. But what you can do, it costs absolutely no money. You just have to organize it. And you can go onto our website, vetstownhall.org, for a very, very simple sort of best practices about how to do this process. You open up the town hall, you turn on the PA system, you send out announcements, you send out word that you're doing this. And any veteran of any war who served in any capacity has the right to stand up and speak for 10 minutes about what it felt like to serve this nation overseas.
Before we get to the second half of our interview, I want to take a quick second to thank our sponsors. This week's episode is brought to you by FieldSeats.com. FieldSeats.com is an e-commerce, federally licensed firearms dealer. They provide virtual reviews on brand new firearms, optics, and gear, where at the end of the review, they give away the item being reviewed to an attendee. Currently, they've got reviews and giveaways up ranging from $20 for a brand new Smith & Wesson M&P Shield M2.09 millimeter,
to $50 for a new Christensen Arms CA556. Each review has limited seating, so your chances of winning the giveaway are that much higher. Check out fieldseats.com to purchase your reviews and enter to win the item being reviewed, and use the code LethalMinds to get 10% off your order. Be sure to also check out their Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at field_seats for updates on products and other tips and info. Use code LethalMinds to receive 10% off your entire purchase at fieldseats.com. Terms and conditions apply.
It doesn't matter if you're combat or support or whatever. It doesn't matter, right? You had an experience that you chose. And although we've also had Vietnam vets who were drafted, World War II vets who were drafted. but nevertheless, you did the nation's work over there. And the fallout, the emotional fallout, shouldn't be just yours. And the pride in what you did shouldn't be just yours either. It should be all, you know, to belong to the whole nation, right? As it would have for the Kiowa. And if you, you know, like to say that you support the troops, great. Like, I like the phrase. It doesn't sort of mean a whole lot, but no problem. I like it. That means showing up for a couple of hours once a year to listen to veterans tell their stories. And you will hear the most extraordinary stories. You will hear veterans who are very proud, some veterans who are very angry, some veterans who literally are crying too hard to talk, which is its own kind of testimony. And I feel like not only does it help vets, but it brings communities together. It's totally apolitical, which allows people to experience being in one place at the center of a community without being identified by their political markers, by their political beliefs. We are all there as citizens. That's it. End of sentence. And it's a very powerful experience for all involved. And I really urge people to do it. It doesn't cost a dime, and it's really very simple to set up.
Right. I mean, I think it's such an interesting concept, right? Because like you said, you mentioned in there, there's these phrases, you know, support the troops or the parades that'll happen around, you know, Veterans Day to thank our service members. And the phrase, thank you for your service, which I personally started hearing like an hour after I graduated from boot camp and went into town in my uniform. Like, it starts instantly. Now, that's a product, I would argue, of this current generation. And in some ways, I think the country's like almost atoning for the way we treated our Vietnam veterans, and that there's still this like this resurgence right now of like almost lip service, right? These kind of, I don't want to say they're empty gestures, because I feel like that's projecting a little bit too much onto it, but it's an action, right? That's an action, giving out a coupon or a free meal or something. While there's some good intention there, it's an action. And what you're talking about is the opposite of action, which is listening, right? Is to sit there and just listen. Now, I mean, this is also something that this concept, somebody getting up and speaking, it's not new necessarily, right? Like you said, there's other cultures that have done it. This is the way a lot of group therapy groups are set up, like Alcoholics Anonymous and even the idea of confession through the Catholic Church, right? Do you see a current, like the power really comes from giving a stage to an individual?
Yeah, I mean, there's something very powerful in bearing witness to another person's experience.
Right.
And the forum, as you mentioned, say of AA, where it's a benevolent and non-judgmental, but also no bullshit environment.
Right.
You are totally safe to confess the things you are most ashamed of. You're encouraged to, right? And people will listen without judgment and support you. And you know what? It's an act of great patriotism to listen to be anti-war. I grew up in a liberal household, right? And I have a very nuanced, I think, I hope, very nuanced understanding of when we do and don't need to go to war as a nation, right? I mean, I have my own opinions about all this, but my background is very liberal, right? And I think it's a great act of patriotism for someone who is implacably opposed to war in all cases, which is not me, but to listen with respect and real attention and lack of judgment to a soldier saying, you know what, my service is the thing I'm most proud of, right? And this is a great nation, and I served it well, and, you know, et cetera. Like, it's an act of real patriotism to not agree with the war that person fought, but to bear witness to what they the way they experienced it. Likewise, people who are, I don't want to say pro-war because that just sounds absurd, but who do not particularly question U.S. rationale for going to war, Vietnam and Iraq, for example, wars that were, you know, quite, you know, history has shown to be quite questionable in their judgment, but they're really, you know, really sort of like completely accepting of that. To bear witness, to stand and listen without judgment to a Vietnam vet saying, you know what, that whole thing was complete bullshit, right? We were sent to die in a war that made no sense, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you stand and listen to that without judgment because that's their experience too. And we're all Americans. We have to figure out how to make all this work. Those are acts of real patriotism and real unity in this country. And, you know, I feel like our political leaders, not all of them, but enough of them to make this happen. Some of our political leaders have actually tried to exacerbate the cultural, economic, and political divisions in this country that exist in any country, make them worse because it benefits these individuals politically. It is their fault. It is our leaders' fault. And we fell for it, but it's our leaders' fault that the country is that we're at each other's throats politically. And I think one way to start healing that is you're never going to reform the politicians, right? There's too much money in politics. There's too much power. It's too corrupt. It's never happening, right? But from the ground up, you can change things. And I think from the ground up, American citizens have to start tuning out their leader, the toxic leaders that we have, some of the toxic leaders that we have, and understand that your strongest ally is your fellow citizen you may not agree with. At the end of the day, that's your strongest ally, and that's America's strongest form of defense against fascism and terrorism and everything else that the world has to offer the unfortunate nation.
Well, you know, in some ways, we're more connected than we've ever been, right? Through the use of social media, the internet, that global perspective is more. I mean, we're watching things happen instantly, simultaneously. We're not waiting for this, and in some ways, I would think that would make us that level of clarity would bring us closer together. But clearly, that's not the case in a lot of ways. Like you said, there's a lot to be gained by keeping attrition going and keeping people at each other's throats, speaking broadly. Now, these experiences so far, because this organization, Vets Town Hall, has been around for a little while now, is there any experiences that have stuck with you attending any of these events or any moments you could share with us that have kind of shown the power of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the early ones, I mean, I think some of these people have passed on, I think. I'm not sure we're going to get any more World War II vets. But in the very beginning, this is 2015, you know, we had a couple of World War II vets. The most extraordinary stories, right? You know, one guy who signed up at 16, maybe, and fought in the Pacific. Like, crazy stories, right? Amazing, amazing stories. And he said he came home and he wore a knife around his ankle for the rest of his life, just to make sure, right? Amazing guy. There were people who were still deep in grief about people they lost and struggling with the idea that it was their fault. Just heartbreaking stories. There was one older lady in her 70s who stood up. This was the first one with Representative Seth Moulton, who also offered an extraordinary story as a Marine lieutenant in the in Ramadi or Fallujah, I can't remember which, but taking a break because he was personally exhausted and he needed water and he needed to take a knee for 5 minutes. And I think they were in a cemetery. And during that break, one of his men took a bullet in the forehead. Imagine the guilt.
Right.
And that's why he was awarded some high medal of courage for his service. And he never mentions it to the media. He's a politician, right? He never mentions it to the media because he just thinks, why should I get that when I didn't bring that boy home?
right.
you know, alive, and very, very powerful. But so many, many stories like that. But finally, I'll just to rearrange everyone's brain for a moment. There was an older lady who stood up, and I was like, "You're wait, what's happening here?" And she said, "I fought in Vietnam in the infantry," and I said, "Wait, oh, wait a second." And she said, "And then I came home and got a sex change." And here I am. And it was a pretty conservative audience, and everyone, I was like, "Oh, yes, America, like, awesome, right? Like that can happen. Fantastic." And you know what? Oh, you know, the conservatives or even the liberals out there, they're uncomfortable with this kind of thing. This person fought for your country. Like, they are a freaking patriot. So you better take them as they are. At, you know, like right now in their life, like honor that, because, you know, that's one of the things that makes this country great is that that can happen, and that, you know, like that we can honor it in a meeting like this. It's extraordinary.
Well, it's also interesting you bring up that this is multiple generations of different veterans, right? Like if you had World War II veterans showing up, and that generation is quickly escaping us. And there is kind of this. This grab to hold on to those stories and grab those experiences before they're gone forever. And I mean, did you notice, was there, so what I'm getting at is like, there's a factor of time in here, right? The guy who just got out of the Marine Corps 6 months ago is a lot different than the guy who got out 3 decades ago, 4 decades ago, who's at the very end of their life, with a completely different perspective. Did you notice any change, like were the stories kind of aligned along a timeline in that fashion, that people's perspectives softened or hardened based on where they were at in their post service?
No, I mean, I don't think I didn't see any pattern like that. I mean, there was a sort of basic division. I mean, there was a sort of basic divisions of people who were in deep sorrow, and that was their primary emotion, right? And then there are people who maybe were grieving somebody, but were their dominant emotion was that they're very proud of their service, and then there were, you know, there were way fewer, but there are some people who were quite angry. Vietnam and frankly Iraq as well, right? Not Afghanistan so much, which sort of corresponds with my feelings about the two wars. I didn't cover Iraq because, frankly, I was against it, and I didn't think I could be objective. Afghanistan, I understood the rationale, morally, legally, politically, strategically, and I got it after 9/11, and I was for it. And I, you know, I've been going to Afghanistan since the mid-90s. It was a country that I was very fond of way before 9/11 happened. And then after 9/11, I thought, oh my God, you know, America could really do a lot of good in Afghanistan, you know, if we do this right. Unfortunately, I don't think we did. But so you there was a little bit of that in the responses. Iraq, there was a lot of bitterness around Iraq. And then there was, you know, a sort of subset of this, which was sometimes people who really would sort of confess, like, I didn't do enough. I didn't fight. I was just, you know, quote, just a supply clerk or whatever. And you know, some people get really teary. Like, I'm ashamed. Like, I wish I could have done more. And it was, those in some ways were really the heartbreaking people. I was leading a talk once, and a guy stood up, a big, tough looking dude. Like, some ways the bigger and tougher they are, the harder they cry. I don't know. It's crazy. Right. And this guy stood up and he was a CB, and he, you know, his job was to build stuff on these remote bases. And he said, you know, nothing happened. Like, it wasn't hard. And I feel guilty that I didn't do more. And he said until at one point a platoon came in from a lot of combat deep in the mountains or wherever he was. He was in Afghanistan. He said they were dirty. They were beat up. They had a hell of a few weeks. And they came in, and he had built them a sort of plywood platform to like sleep on out of the dirt at this fire base. And he said they all like came up and shook his hand and thanked him. They were so grateful. And as he told this story, you know, this wasn't a vet's town hall. It was just an event somewhere. as he told this story, he started crying. And he was enormously embarrassed to me, crying because he was a 6'3" Marine, right? And he's crying in front of a bunch of people. And I wanted to sort of help him. And I don't know, like do something, right? And so I said, thank you. And I said to everybody, I said, he's crying. He's doing our crying for us. Like, okay, War is a serious thing and we should all be crying, but we're not. He's crying for us. And really we should thank him because we should all be doing what he's doing right now. And we're not. And at that point, half the room started crying and we were good. So, you know, just, a friend of mine was joking, like, Sebastian Younger making grown men cry since 1997, right? So you know, but there's, you know, when you're at that level of emotion, there's something real going on there, right? And listen, I have a long and terrible history of making sure I don't cry when I should be, you know, I should be feeling something, you know. So I know exactly how this works, and you know, frankly, how damaging it can be to a person.
Right. I mean, I think that's also an interesting topic. Is how do the audiences react in events like this? Like, because for me personally, I can always tell how approximately close an individual is to a military community by the way they react to when they found out that I served in the Marine Corps, right? Because sometimes people take on this like seriousness that, like, I don't know, like for me, it was, and I'm one of those individuals who, you know, had some of these feelings of like, I should have done more a little bit because I was 6 years in the reserves, the Marine Corps, and in, you know, in an infantry MOS, and I never deployed, right? I never saw, my closest experience to war was very, very distant, just knowing people who had been there and done that. And I personally, you know, I have my own ways of having dealt with that and I feel fine now, but it's interesting to me that what, like the first or second question people will ask me, once they find out I was in the Marine Corps, well, where did you deploy to? You know, that's like the first thing I have to. And, you know, my answer is like, well, Long Island, you know, that's where I was for 6 years, more or less. You know, that's not, I didn't go to Afghanistan. I wasn't in Iraq or anything like that. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, some people who, you know, they were in the military themselves or they had a spouse or whatever. We jump right over that. There's a certain communication that's just already established because we come from that shared experience in whatever way, regardless of whether they went to war or they didn't or whatever. There's just a commonality there. But there's individuals who, like, they don't know how to act almost. They don't know how to act from the second they find out about the military. They do the thank you for your service thing. And I think this is an interesting experiment and an interesting venture in the sense that it gives veterans a way to just get up there and share their experiences, you know, just total freedom. What have audience reactions been like? Or is it individuals showing up who are already kind of involved with military communities?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of probably a predominance of military connected people in the audience, but not exclusively, but they're very, you know, they're very, very welcoming and compassionate. And we part of the package that you will download if you want to do a Vets Town Hall, part of the package are some sort of instructions about what to say to the audience before this kicks off and how it all sort of worked, just the sort of, you know, like clockwork aspect of it. Like, this happens and that happens. But one of the things we say, we're very explicit about, is this is not political and this is not a forum to argue the merits of a war, right? This, do not do it. This is not, there's no Q&A, and we will tolerate absolutely no back and forth about whether we should have or shouldn't have fought this or that war. So war is divisive and it should be divisive. It's the worst thing there is, right? So if it's not divisive, we're in trouble, right? I mean, if you don't have people saying the opposite thing to get everyone to examine their assumptions, you're going to have some problems, right? And so, but we don't want that in a Vets Town Hall where the point isn't to sort out which wars to fight and not fight. The point is to help the people that fought the wars that we chose as a nation, that we chose, that fought, that, to bring them back, right? And you know, vets talk with each other about their experiences. They're reluctant to talk to other, to civilians, to non-vets about their experiences, but then they complain that they feel like they're not part of society. You can't have it both ways, right? Like, you're not going to feel like you're part of society if you refuse to tell the part of society you're trying to join, like, what you went through.
Yeah.
Even if it was very little, right? Like, And so you can't sort of like, no, they can't understand. They don't deserve to know. This is special knowledge, you know, and then complain. But I feel like I don't fit in. Like, of course you don't feel like you don't fit in. You're not freaking communicating with them, right? So Vets Town Hall is a chance to sort of like stop with that bullshit and like get everyone like on the same page. And I've never seen an adverse negative reaction in a Vets Town Hall. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's a little, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't go to church, but you know, from my understanding of church is people don't raise their hand in the back and start arguing with the priest, right? It's a sacred space. It's a sacred time. Like you're there to experience and listen. That's it.
Right. Well, I mean, I want to say thanks for joining us today and letting us in on this venture that you have going. Is there any plans coming up this Veterans Day for Vets Town Hall?
Yeah. And, you know, again, our organization doesn't itself organize events, right? I mean, we facilitate, we help people organize events locally. Yeah, there's Vets Town Hall over the country. But go on to the website, vetstownhall.org. And it's not too late. You can stand one up in a week, right? I mean, it did just not, you know, there isn't a lot of legwork on these, and there's zero expense basically. So mainly you have to get the word out, and people will come.
Great. Well, we'll definitely make sure we get the word out there. Hopefully some people will step up. We'll see a bunch of these all over the country, and we'll see what comes of it. So thank you again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Be sure to pre-order Sebastian's new book, In My Time of Dying, which comes out in May of 2024. Literature of War has always been about getting books into the hands of our troops, those men and women who are currently serving all over the world right now. We are right in the midst of our first library campaign in which we are attempting to donate 500 books to 5 different units. We are past the halfway mark to our goal, but we still need your help. Please head to the link in our description for ways to donate books to our troops. This episode was recorded at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum in Columbus, Ohio. For more information, please visit nationalvmm.org on ways to support this museum and its mission of helping veterans tell their stories. Lastly, you don't have to be published by a major publishing house for your story to matter. There's a group of veterans in North Carolina who are proving that to be true right now. Brothers and Sisters Like These began as a creative writing program in 2016 for Vietnam veterans who are struggling with PTSD. It has since grown to include veterans from other wars as well. These are men and women from all walks of life who have taken the time to tell their stories in their own voices with their own words. We're going to highlight some of these stories in the coming weeks, but please take a moment to check out their page at brothersandsisterslikethese.com. Once again, I'm your host, Michael Jerome Plunkett, and I will be back in a few weeks with another story and another conversation.
Veterans Radio has a partnership with Literature of War Foundation to exchange podcast content to reach a wider audience regarding issues of interest to veterans, family, and friends. You can find more about Literature of War Foundation at its website, litofwar.com. You can find more about Veterans Radio on Facebook or its website, veteransradio.org. I am Jim Foss-Hone, a host of Veterans Radio and a veterans disability lawyer at legalhelpforveterans.com, a sponsor of this podcast.